Here on Radio 4 FM, we continue our Book of the Week. Tim Moore is riding the route of the infamous 1914 Giro d'Italia road race. Having pedalled from Milan down the west coast, Tim has finally reached Rome. Dipping into the journalist Paolo Facchinetti's book along the way, he's also telling the story of the heroic 1914 competitors, including Alfonso Calzolari. Stephen Mangan reads episode 4 of Geronimo, riding the very terrible 1914 Tour of Italy.
The longest Giro stage of all time, Lucca to Rome, claimed just one retirement in 1914, and 26 riders would turn up on the Stage 4 start line, Rome to Avellino. Paolo's book located this at Porta San Lorenzo, which required me to cycle right through the heart of old Rome. On a hot Saturday, the downtown traffic was wonderfully sparse, and the pavements annexed by foreign pedestrians with better things to do than play chicken with brakeless cyclists. The Porta San Lorenzo lay just behind the main station and was the go-to bathroom destination for this area's many tramps. As I set up my traditional stage start self-timer photo, four of them stood behind me, tipping drinking fountain water down the inside of their grime-waxed jumpers and tracky bottoms. My road out of Rome was a crazy paved horror, full of potholes and rubbish and weekend drivers looking for two-wheeled target practice. The road surface decayed further, now strewn with so much glass, it was as if someone had spent the night throwing chandeliers out of an airship. It didn't seem surprising to pass a completely naked lady beckoning me from the shadows of a lay-by. I gave her a sleepy wave and then noticed a familiar cityscape taking unwelcome shape ahead of me. It was Rome, and I'd just gone back into it through its red light district. With a groan of sickening enlightenment, I realised what had happened. After the sat-nav directed me into Rome on a six-lane motorway the previous day, I'd clicked an option that told it to avoid highways. Its interpretation of this order had led me into the untrafficked wilds and kept me there without any concern for the build-up of excess mileage. Frosinone was my next destination. I was well off the tourist track now, wheeling the Hirondelle through empty squares crammed with church towers. So sharply pitched was old Frosinone that my hotel's basement garage, the Hirondelle's overnight home, opened onto a street 50 feet below the one that passed its front door. Going south the next day gave summer a new lease of life. It was 34 degrees by 10:30. The terrain was manageable, but keeping cool meant keeping the speed up. I stopped to refuel at a small-town grocery run by a motherly signora. When I put a litre of Coke on the counter and pointed at her pastry cabinet, she waggled a chubby finger. The Coke was wordlessly returned to the fridge and replaced by two bottles of beige vegetable juice, along with a packet of quarry tiles.
"Biscotti biologici," she clucked.
I laughed and ingested the cardboard slurry on the bench outside. The afternoon heat was crushing, and my surroundings sombre. Villages were full of neglected shacks, and every other farmhouse was roofless. I headed out onto the motorway and into a blue-skied nightmare. Lorries crossed each other when there was no room to do so, shunting me into the roadside verge with a dragon-like hiss of hydraulics. Soon, every time an HGV approached, I wobbled into the undergrowth and waited for it to pass. I counted my blessings as they screamed by. That one might have killed me. Or that one. Or that one. Finally, I cracked completely, darted through a gap in the traffic and bounced away up a rustic footpath. The enormity of my relief made everything in the very different Italy I now entered seem wonderful. Even the bits that definitely weren't. Between the gnarled olives and plump dark grapes, my path was overhung by sheaves of bamboo and steer-clear cascades of prickly pears. A tropical vibe enhanced by the sun-bleached shantytowns I passed through. Soon I was into a great swathe of moribund cultivation, all haunted farmhouses and overgrown orchards hung with rotten fruit. Approaching Caserta, tarmac and acceptably small vehicles returned. Coke, carbs, coffee. After the usual bar raid splash and dash, I went back out to do battle with the swelling hills and the midday sun. Horse carts trundled through fields of tobacco, and every cottage garden seemed blessed with a tree full of cricket ball pomegranates. The air freshened, and the settlement seemed progressively better groomed. Avellino had the look of a prosperous town in the French Alps. This was the finish line of the leg from Rome, four down and four left. I pushed the Hirondelle through the piazza's ageless lawns and fountains. It was gone five, and sitting on a bench in the clear bright sun with Paolo's book in my lap, I was rashly galvanised by the tale of Riccardo Palea, one of the surviving trio of rank amateur aspiranti. On the run into Avellino, a cart ran Palea over, inflicting terrible head injuries. The doctors were unable to save the sight in one of his eyes. Yet when stage five started out at 4 a.m, there he was, on his bike, just his mouth, nostrils and one eye visible through a hefty swaddle of bandage. Stage 5, Avellino to Bari, was comfortably the shortest of the race. It was also, in the estimation of the Gazzetta dello Sport's correspondent, the most debilitating. At least 200 of the 328 kilometres are painfully steep, the road always up and down, without a moment's respite. Had my Italian been better, I'd have understood enough of this to have stayed overnight in Avellino. As it was, in failing light, I progressed ever more agonisingly up the Campanian Alps, through the hazelnuts, and at horrid length into the lonesome mountain pines. Piles of leaves and twigs were heaped across a road that didn't see much action these days, as further evidenced by the derelict holiday chalets leering creepily at me through the dark conifers. At 900 metres, the temperature sank to 12 degrees, but I was frothing death sweat. How I longed to rip that hateful woolen jersey off and hurl it into the plunging abyss, followed by these hateful woolen shorts. With the elastic gone and the safety pin bent, they spent the day working their way down my hips, leading to unseemly and sometimes illegal scenes by late afternoon. The road topped out by a desolate clearing strewn with litter. Then two shiny squares bounced the last rays of sunset into my hooded eyes, and I shuffled the Hirondelle across the gravel. Embedded in the wall of rock was a pair of small, hand-decorated tiles, each portraying a cyclist in traditional kit astride his machine. The blue-glazed words beneath were in a cursive, old-school hand, and the iron frames around them bore rusty witness to the passing of many hard winters. "Ad Angelo," began the first. My brain stumbled through the translation. "To Angelo, carry on with your climb. We will always be at your wheel." The second, "To Benedetto Corrado, unforgettable companion of so many climbs." I stood there in the gathering gloom and cried. No one does poetic eulogy and pathos better than the Italians. Every town in Italy boasts some small pocket of loveliness, but if Monte Corvino had one, it hid it well. But pulling back my red nylon bedspread in my rather strange hotel, I accepted that Monte Corvino Rovella was no worse than many British towns. In the morning, the TV hall outside the basement games room was dotted with geriatrics. At last, the pre-decimal penny dropped. This was an old people's home. Or to quote the website, the largest hotel for pensioners in southern Italy. Suddenly, I understood why my ensuite had been carpeted in non-slip mats, and why I'd woken up in the sweaty small hours to yank off a heavy plastic undersheet. Vietri di Potenza was penciled in as my next overnight stop. A flick through Paolo sealed the deal. After Vietri, the road became worse. Riders faced a terrible ascent of many kilometres on a surface of big stones. I descended the fearsome hairpins that snaked down from Vietri di Potenza's rocky pinnacle, then wound through its quiet, narrow streets in a state of weary dismay. If I'd learned one thing in the last few days, it was not to count on finding a bed in even quite sizable towns down here. So this time I decided to ask strangers for help. The people of Vietri could certainly boast a promising record of assisting cyclists in need. When the 1914 front runners rode up to the dreaded post-Vietri section, they were astonished to find townspeople crouched by the roadside with hammers and chisels, making the big stones on the route smaller. It proved no great challenge to connect the current inhabitants with this distant act of dedication. Everyone I saw could have participated in it. I stopped by a horseshoe bench, tightly packed with half a dozen silent elders. Scusi, signore, hotel? Nothing. As I rammed a weary foot into the toe clips, a cracked whisper rose from the far end of the bench.
Hotel in Potenza.
I issued a general thank you, then rode round the corner to stifle my screams. Potenza, I knew, was miles away, beyond what was left of daylight and my own physical reserves. Every kilometre that followed was acquired at ruinous cost. The Gazzetta dello Sport 1914 Giro correspondent reported, 12-15 kilometres of ascent up the gravel, without moral support, without a word of comfort, 3 or 4 kilometres down, then back up. So slow, so painful, so insidious. Tell me about it. The sat-nav told me we were at 950 metres, and then it told me no more. A blank screen. The battery had gone. As I'd been off map for some time, this was a most exciting turn of events. Very soon I found my path blocked by half a dozen stocky, beetle-browed men. They were shepherds, I decided, having seen a few sheep dotted about. I hoped that these men used the 6-foot staves they toted to prod ruminants rather than cripple foreigners.
Potenza?
I said, sounding like Oliver asking for seconds.
Potenza!
Came the mocking, trilled echo. Sour, gruff laughter broke out, giving way to a garlic-scented chant as I forced my way through a corridor of dark and dirty faces. Suddenly the hill seemed much less steep than it had, and I crested it at some speed. It was now past 8, and entirely black. My senses tuned into nothing but distant barks and the chirrup of nocturnal insects. I'd already tried out a bus shelter bench for size when a roadside light drew me onwards. A moment later, Gerard Lagrosse's filthy, clacking shoes were disrupting the solemn gentility of the Bougainville Hill Resort and Wellness Space. It would be 36 hours before they clacked back out. The following day, I enjoyed an unusually contemplative Paolo session, soaking up the full awfulness of the 1914 Giro's 5th stage. Only now did I note that it had taken place in driving rain, which sluiced away all but the heaviest, sharpest stones from the road. At Eboli, Calzolari skidded into a ditch, so slippery with mud that he couldn't haul himself out. The other front runners ignored his cries and rode on by. His last remaining teammate was dressing his leader's muddy wounds in the road when one of the press cars came steaming round the corner. After a great, slithering screech, it stopped with its muddy front wheels resting against Alfonso Calzolari's left leg. The rain clattered against my balcony windows as I lay on my bed and read. A complimentary soundtrack to 1914.
Episode 4 of Geronimo, Riding the Very Terrible 1914 Tour of Italy by Tim Moore, was read by Stephen Mangan, abridged by Libby Spurrier, and produced by Joanna Green. It's a peer production of BBC Radio 4.
At 6, everything made sense. To me.
Take your sister's dress off this minute!
10 new voices.
Maybe you could dedicate the building to my wife.
What's her name?
Mrs. Boris Klovsky. That way, if anything happens and I have to get remarried, it would still be named after my wife.
10 afternoon dramas.
He's dark and mysterious, you know. Darcy-ish.
Thank you.
Weekdays at 2:15. Catch up with original British dramatists on the BBC Radio 4 website.